Welcome to the Brain and Bag Podcast, Friday installment of What in the World. And my name's Andre. I'm joined by my co-host Ryan. And we are going to discuss what in the world is happening in our country and also in the world, as the title says. So the first thing I want to flag is a professor at the University of Chicago, Dr. Robert Pape, released a study with CPOST, the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, that sought to look at the actual insurrectionists at the January 6th riots at the Capitol. And while for some this information might be obvious, to others it is quite interesting because, I mean, you have had people who have sometimes suggested that these insurrectionists were driven by economic motives. Others vehemently disagree, have said that they were driven by racism. And frankly, this study sort of looks at those insurrectionists and does have some interesting findings. First, many of those who are actually involved in the insurrection were quote unquote older, more professional than right-wing protesters that CPOST has looked at in the past. Dr. Pape writes that typically these folks had no ties to existing right-wing groups, but like earlier protesters, they are 95% white, 85% male, and they actually, many of them live near and among Biden supporters in blue and purple counties, end quote. That's from Dr. Pape's article in the Washington Post that sort of summarized his findings. We'll be linking that in the description for this episode. But I think the interesting thing for me, at least, was that, you know, these insurrectionists, they weren't usually from deep red counties. They weren't from deep red counties. About 52% of them were actually from blue counties that Biden had won by a good margin. Dr. Pape writes that the counties with the most significant declines in the non-Hispanic white population are the most likely to produce insurrectionists who now face the charges, quote unquote. He talks about the example of Dallas and Houston, a good amount of those insurrectionists coming from there, those cities being blue cities, but also those cities who have seen demographic shifts in the past few years, the past few decades. It's a very interesting study, and Dr. Pape talks about this theory of the Great Replacement, which essentially asserts that white populations are being replaced, progressively replaced, by minorities, which has contributed to basically mass immigration and birth rates. And then obviously he talks about social media, certainly, you know, with social media and its echo chambers. It has sort of driven that view. And he says that that replacement theory, the theory of great replacement, might sort of tell us a bit about why so many of these insurrectionists were actually from these rapidly shifting demographic counties. These counties with rapidly shifting demographics. I can jumble my English a bit. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things here. And three things kind of stand out to me. The first being that they're older. We typically see mobilization occurring with younger populations, even on both sides of the political spectrum. And so that's interesting in particular, and also that they're professional. Again, we usually see individuals, particularly on the right, with lower degrees of education who are tied to these groups. But I guess when you said that there's no ties to groups, that also kind of raises alarm bells in my head, because the fact that they were able to kind of all congregate and then coordinate is fascinating, that they didn't actually have these formal ties to these fringe groups. And so those are two interesting things. A third one is one you already touched on, that being that these individuals lived among Democrats or people who voted for Joe Biden. They lived in blue areas. And so again, this highlights the demographic shift, how that might be kind of creating this, I guess, maybe fear or uneasiness within the minds of these individuals who are maybe seeing jobs that, you know, maybe they or their family are holding kind of being, you know, taken, quote unquote, taken by minority groups. And that, of course, leads to racism. And so, I one, it's, you know, the whole idea that it's economic driven probably not the case. This seems to be a bit more deep-seated, more ideological than that. And so a very interesting report. There's a lot more we have to learn about the events of January 6th in order to be more prepared for far-right groups and any attempts by the fringe to kind of take action against the U.S. government. And so I think Dr. Pape's work is certainly a step in the right direction.
Yeah, certainly. And like, I mean, it provides evidence for why certain claims are wrong, why certain claims are right. So, I mean, that is political science research to an extent. But certainly people will be evaluating his work. People will be reviewing his work for whether or not it is the right type of work. But yeah, Ryan, what else is happening?
Well, there's a lot on my list today. I mean, it's been quite a busy week. Let's start with Northern Ireland. So there's been six consecutive nights of violence in Northern Ireland. You've had the British and Irish leaders, as well as the U.S., kind of come out and condemn this. There's clashes between the unionists and the nationalists. And so we have this unrest first breakout last week. There's rising tensions because of COVID and Brexit. Brexit has put particular pressure on Northern Ireland. And so I think it's important to note, I mean, a bus was set on fire in Northern Ireland. There's been petrol bombs that have been thrown, projectiles, people clashing. We've had police officers injured. And so, I mean, really, to kind of understand this, we have to go back to 1998, the Good Friday Agreement, which basically set up this power-sharing agreement between Protestants and Catholics. It ended 30 years of political violence in Northern Ireland, and so, that conflict resulted in the death of more than 3,000 people. And so, you know, given the pressures of Brexit, this is again kind of reigniting the Northern Ireland issue and whether or not it's going to be its own state or whether it's going to stay within the United Kingdom. And so I think, and as we talked about over and over again, you know, pandemics accelerate history. And this is just another example that I'm not sure this might have happened had we not had the pressures of COVID-19. And we can look around the world. There are many maybe instances that you can maybe point to. Of course, you know, correlation is not causation, but it's certainly a compelling case can be made.
Yeah, certainly. It's very interesting. I mean, do you think that this will sort of give way to more violence, or what do you think?
I'm not necessarily sure that we'll see more violence, but we're certainly going to see efforts within the Northern Irish government and within the Irish government to maybe reintegrate Ireland. Because there are nationalists within Northern Ireland that want Ireland to be whole again. But of course, you have the loyalists in Northern Ireland who want to maintain their ties to the UK. And so, and of course, I mean, the UK doesn't want to lose Northern Ireland. It's a very contentious political issue. And so I don't really see this actually going as far as one of those extremes as, you know, when you have real actual violence, but this is kind of, it's going to heat up. It's already heating up. There's definitely going to be a significant police response just because the UK is not going to allow this to occur.
It'll be very interesting to see what happens there. I mean, it's a very dicey situation. And Ryan, as you said, pandemics accelerate history. We've seen this time and time and time again. But now I sort of want to move a bit south, a bit east into Jordan, because there's been some interesting situations going on there with the royal family. So basically, Jordan is ruled by King Abdullah II, who is relatively young. He's about 49. He is seen as a more modern Middle Eastern leader. He's known for riding his motorcycles everywhere. He's an interesting guy. He's an interesting guy and seen as very westernized to an extent. But basically, in the past few days, his government, the king's government, has accused Prince Hamza, who was also a former crown prince, of basically hatching a plot to quote-unquote undermine the security of the country. So the prince was claimed he was under house arrest, and you hadn't seen from him in a few days. But now King Abdullah has stated that, like, okay, like, you know, the family squabble is over. There won't be any security risks. You know, Prince Hamza is, quote, with his family in his palace under my care. And it'll be sort of very interesting to see what happens. But I mean, President Biden had to express a call of solidarity with King Abdullah. I mean, President Biden called the king and expressed his support for the monarchy in Jordan. It'll be very interesting to see what happens there. I mean, it was, I think, geopolitically, like, I mean, many people were concerned about, is the Jordanian government going to stick around? And Jordan's typically a stable country in a Middle East that is full of countries, many of which are not stable. So, and you don't usually hear about problems happening there. So,
yeah, monarchical infighting, when you think of it, you don't really look to Jordan, but this royal competition between the king and his younger half brother apparently has been going on for quite a long time. And given the government's response to COVID-19, right? I mean, 7,000 people have died. There's a population of 10 million. Unemployment's to about 25%. And so there's this unhappiness with the government. And I think allegedly Prince Hamza is trying to seize on this maybe decline in the king's popularity. But of course, the king has many allies, both in the country and abroad. And so he's cracking down. And I mean, when you look at it, right, the crown prince of Jordan is the king's son, Hussein. And so it's looking like that, and any efforts to kind of undermine the king's power will be clamped down on significantly. And so this is basically just the king demonstrating to all of those within the potential opposition, or even within his family, that it's not going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it looks like it's been, you know, it's been clamped down on, like everything's sort of back to normal. But I mean, for the U.S. and U.S. interests in the Middle East, an unstable Jordan is the last thing you need.
Right. Israel would not be happy about it. Saudi would not be happy about it. The U.S. certainly would not be happy about it. And so, right. I mean, I think that the United States and its allies would do everything it can do in its power to maintain a Jordan status quo.
Yeah, and this isn't just like some Prince Harry and Meghan Markle on Oprah sort of situation. This is like an actual security risk.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So let's move to Russia and Ukraine next. There's a lot going on. Basically, you have Russia mobilizing on Ukraine's borders. Of course, Russia has backed these separatist movements and these governments within eastern Ukraine in Donetsk and Luhansk. And now Moscow is saying that it could defend these Russia-backed rebels. You even have a top Putin official saying that a war with Ukraine would end Ukraine, and that, you know, if war were to break out near Russia's border, Russia would defend itself and ethnic Russians. And so this is kind of coming to a head, right? Where we are seeing mass mobilization. You're seeing Russian troops going into Crimea, which was illegally annexed. And now you're seeing the movement of troops and personnel and equipment to the easternmost border. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has met with NATO leaders. He's met with and talked with Western leaders. Angela Merkel of Germany has called on Russia to reduce its presence on the border. And so it really looks like Russia is kind of ready for battle. And it's really fascinating, just because this almost came out of nowhere.
Yeah, it absolutely did come out of nowhere. And I mean, the United States, they are deliberating a response. So the U.S. Navy generally does operate near the Black Sea and in the Black Sea. But defense officials, according to CNN, have just stated that they are considering sending some U.S. warships into the Black Sea in a show of solidarity with Ukraine, especially as Russia is sort of building up this military presence. According to CNN, the United States has to give a 14-day warning if they're supposed to enter the Black Sea, which is part of this 1936 treaty, which gives Turkey control of that sort of entryway. We don't know necessarily if that warning has been given, but it'll be interesting to see if the U.S. actually does send in those naval ships, because, I mean, that would be certainly a show of force to Russia.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on here, right? I mean, in one aspect, it could be Russia attempting to flex its muscles to kind of see how far it can actually go. On the other hand, it might be an attempt to distract from the internal issues within Russia. You, of course, have Alexei Navalny, the opposition politician in Russia, who is dying in a Russian prison, basically.
He's in an infirmary. No, he got moved to an infirmary, apparently.
So, yeah. So clearly his situation is far worse, that he has to be moved to an infirmary. And so things are not looking good for him. He, of course, you know, his death would kind of spark revolt within Russia, or certainly within the democratic circles there. And you also have, significant economic issues, which put pressure on the Putin regime. And so, again, this kind of sparks in my mind, glimmers of the annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the reasonings behind that. You had, similar issues on the world stage, Russia, kind of not able to find its path, Putin kind of undergoing his own kind of popularity struggles. And so right now, with Putin just signing a law that'll keep him potentially in power for life, he'll be able to run for the presidency again twice more with these constitutional changes. This might be just one big distraction, but, again, that's merely speculation. There's a lot of people who are, far more equipped to kind of answer or provide sort of explanations about it. But on one hand, it might be a test of the West. On the other, it might be a distraction internally. It might be both. Who's to say?
Yeah, you never know. And they had the vote on the law, right? But he had just signed the law, I think, this past week or last week or something. That gives him that opportunity to rule until 2036, barring any health circumstances, which I think he will likely do. I think he will very likely rule until 2036. The guy's seen so many presidents, from all the way back to Clinton on December 31st, New Year's Eve, 1999, all the way through Biden.
Well, certainly in his interest, right? How can he guarantee his own security if he's not on the top? I don't think so.
Well, you never know. Even when he wasn't on the top, he was.
Right.
Medvedev had that 4-year stint as president, which was basically Putin as prime minister having all the power.
Right. Yeah.
And then Medvedev is gone. Who hears about Medvedev anymore? No one.
No, he was pushed aside. The internal politics of Russia is fascinating. Kremlinology is certainly still very popular. And so I would, again, pay attention to what's happening in Ukraine. The U.S. will not just stand by as Russia engages in this aggression, nor will NATO. And so this could get pretty, pretty tricky pretty quickly.
Yeah. Does it bear any similarity, I guess, to Russia's actions in Georgia in 2008 during the latter end of the Bush administration, or the 2014 taking of Crimea? Is the U.S. response going to resemble that? With Georgia, was there even a response?
Right.
In 08, was there? Because we had the reset right after.
There wasn't a substantive response, I would say. There was a kind of a response in 2014, but no real response that actually deterred Russian action. And so I imagine that President Biden, just given his team and given his stance on Russia, will draw some sort of red line. But we all know the consequences of drawing a red line. And so hopefully he'll learn from the Obama years.
Consequences of drawing a red line, and then the adversary just steps right over the red line.
So right, exactly.
Red line.
Yeah, you got to keep moving the red line. You don't want to do that. There's no point of having a red line. Anyway, again, a lot to unpack there. A lot of updates will likely happen over the next week, and so we'll see. But this is certainly something I'd pay attention to, and that I will be paying attention to, just because we're seeing Russia likely going to potentially either support separatist movements, which can undermine the sovereignty of Ukraine, or maybe actually invade. And so really just deeply a deeply serious situation happening on the Ukrainian border.
A very deeply serious situation. There's been, something that I've been very curious about has been with regards to the situation in Myanmar. So, as we know, the military junta has sort of taken over after they did a coup against the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi, who is, again, back under house arrest or in prison. But I'm sort of curious about this diplomatic corps that the Myanmar government has, because they're now ambassadors and some envoys who are I think there was an ambassador who was locked out of the London embassy or something. There's some fissures within their diplomatic corps, because some diplomats are in favor of the old government, some are loyalists to the new government. I don't even know what is happening there. The envoy who actually criticized the coup was locked out of his own embassy in London because he criticized the Myanmar military. And then we saw some envoys in the UN sort of speak out, and Yeah.
It's not looking good. Apparently the deputy chief of mission there, so the second in command of that embassy, who is loyal to the military, has basically blacklisted the chief of mission, which is insane in the diplomatic world. But yeah, it's looking like, you know, people are picking sides in Myanmar, and the military right now is winning.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, they're just killing all these innocent protesters as well. And in addition to having that military campaign against, I think, some separatists as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming a very bloody situation in Myanmar. You, of course, have, you know, the issue with the minority groups there. And now you have this political issue. And so, yeah, I mean, I imagine there's got to be some sort of more substantive U.S. and democratic country response to this action, just because, I mean, Myanmar was, a solid country, right? I mean, there, of course, the issues with the Rohingya Muslim minority in the country, but I mean, all said and done, right? It was that's certainly a big issue, but the country wasn't, you know, a military junta.
Well, I mean, they had been one for like a long time, and like this shift to democracy only happened very recently. So, I mean,
yeah,
it was a very weak democracy, as we can now see. So,
yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, keep your eyes on Myanmar as well. Andre, it's time to talk about Sofagate.
Sofagate, which is, I mean, it's the most like sexist thing you could imagine, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was the president of Turkey. President Erdogan, and what was the other guy's name?
You had Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen, who were there meeting with the Turkish president Erdogan and the foreign minister. And basically, right, you have these two chairs.
Ryan, who are those two individuals you mentioned at the beginning, aside from President Erdogan of Turkey?
Yeah. Yep. So Charles Michel is the president of the European Council, which is basically kind of just an organization, an institution within the European Union that is an amalgam of the heads of state. And so they make a lot of the big kind of state-to-state kind of organizing and planning of the European Union. And then you have Ursula von der Leyen, who leads the European Commission, which is basically the executive branch of the EU. And so these are two very important individuals. And they're not, it's not like one is, you know, higher than the other as far as hierarchy. Right, they're in charge of different institutions, and so it is incredibly sexist for them to relegate Ursula von der Leyen to the couch, which is where you had the foreign minister, who is directly down the line in the hierarchy in Turkey, be on par with her. So they should have had an extra chair for her. It is a diplomatic snafu, and really just kind of shows how bad of a dude Erdogan is. I mean, come on, really? Like, this is such an easy thing not to do.
Really shows his regard for women.
Yeah, not great. But again, Turkey is an important partner of the EU, so I can't imagine this has any substantive impact. It's just wrong.
Yep. Aside from that, Ryan, that meeting, is there anything else that's happening? I know we have a few minutes left, but...
Yeah, I have one more thing that kind of just came across my news feed, and I don't really know that much about it, I'll be honest, but the Singapore deputy prime minister is deciding to step away from the prospect of future leadership. And this came as a shock. And so basically on Thursday, he announced that he's stepping aside so that younger leaders could kind of have the runway to kind of engage in the country's politics. And so, I mean, basically this is kind of creating a big opening. And so he, this leader was said he would stay on as in his role for quite a long time. And so this is kind of driving Singapore politics into a free fall. No one's really certain who will fill this gap. And so Singapore, of course, is a very important economic hub in the region. It's a very, you know, wealthy country and is a financial hotspot. And so you would hope that a country like Singapore could maintain political stability. And I assume that it will, but when you have this level of uncertainty in a country like Singapore, there are of course some questions that are looming.
Yeah, recall Singapore, Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew was the ruler for a long time since that country's founding. His son, Lee Hsien Loong, is currently the prime minister. And I mean, the father and the son have basically ruled the country for like the vast majority of that country's history. So, I mean, this means perhaps the current prime minister, Lee, might stay on for like maybe a little while longer, because I mean, it's very unclear as to who his successor would be. It'll be an insightful thing to see, like, who actually becomes the deputy, just so you sort of know what direction the country will take, if there will be any shifts really in the country's political circumstances, given, you know, this dynastic rule that has sort of happened. And Singapore is like, you know, it's a democracy, right? But I mean, it's the prime minister is very powerful. He's like very powerful, and like, he's not going to lose. Like, it's like a quote unquote democracy, if you know what I mean.
Yep, exactly. But better than most when we do democracy in air quotes. Anyway, that kind of wraps up all we have this week. There's a lot still going on in the world. For all of you listening, thank you very much. We have a lot of great episodes in the pipeline. And make sure to take a listen to this past week's episode. We had a great conversation with Glenn Gristel, the former general counsel of the National Security Agency. We talk about cyber. We talk privacy. We get into a lot of interesting stuff. He's working a lot of great things. So I suggest you check out his work as well. And make sure to check out our newsletter. It releases every week, just to kind of stay tuned with basically kind of what we do here, but in written form. A lot of things happening around the world that we hope you'll all stay apprised of. And so, Andre, that's all I got. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'm Ryan Rosenthal.
I'm Andre Gonawala. See you all next week. Bye.